Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
You know, we did a series of barbecue beers last year to go with a barbecue event that we were holding. So we had, you know, a pastrami-inspired beer and a barbecue sauce-inspired beer. So, there, you know, we'll really do anything.
I'm here with Tom Schmidlin, the owner and head brewer of Postdoc Brewing. And your tap room is located here in a very cozy suite out in Redmond. What are the things that you love about making beer?
I really like all of it. Every bit of the process is fun for me, whether it's milling the grain or even just cleaning out the mash tun. It's all fun for me.
Are there any steps or aspects about crafting beer that people don't know anything about or aren't aware of?
There's a lot that really goes into it, especially when you're brewing on a small scale like we are. You know, on a small scale, there's a lot of manual labor involved. Almost nothing is automated. And the process itself takes anywhere from, you know, 2 weeks to much longer, depending on the type of beer you're making. And I don't know that everyone appreciates necessarily how the process can be different for different beers. The basics are the same, but then when you get into some more complicated beers, there can be pretty radical departures.
How old were you when you had your first beer, and do you remember what it was?
I was younger than I should have been, and I don't remember, other than I know it would have been, you know, a macro lager. I'm sure I didn't like it. By macro lager, I mean, you know, it was probably it could have been a Miller product or a Budweiser product, something along those lines.
By the way, if you're just tuning in, this is Sound Effect, and I'm Jennifer Wing, and I'm talking with Tom Schmidlin, the owner of Postdoc Brewing. And by the way, what's your address here?
It is 17625 Northeast 65th Street, Suite 100 in Redmond, 98052.
And how did you end up in this Suite 100?
It was really just luck. It took us about 18 months to find a good location. There's a lot of requirements as far as what you're looking for in a space when it comes to a brewery, and this met all of them. And the fact that it was right next to Marymore Park was just fantastic.
You know, Sound Effect began in January of 2015, and today the show is celebrating its 100th episode. All of the stories that you'll be hearing come out of Suite 100s across Western Washington. We'll learn about the subculture of glass blowers, we'll visit a workshop that crafts violins, and we'll hang out with some volcanologists, the scientists keeping an eye on all of the volcanoes here in the Northwest. These stories and more today on the 100th episode of Sound Effect. But first, let's have a toast. I'm here with producers Allie Ferguson and Kevin Kniestad, and we are drinking some of the fine Postdoc beers here.
Happy 100.
Happy 100.
Happy 100.
Oh, that's delicious. Well, again, today's show is a little different. Normally, we have a specific theme to connect all of our stories, but as we celebrate the show's 100th episode, we decided to shake things up. All the stories you're about to hear, well, the thing that they have in common is an address, Suite 100, and it's kind of like a game show. What's behind the door? Well, for our first story, the door is a little hard to find. If you drive south on I-5 from Tacoma near Lakewood, just off to the right, there is a two-story office building you could whiz by 100 times and never notice. At 9500 Front Street, you enter Suite 100 from the parking lot in the back. The name on the door, Tacoma Treatment Solutions, doesn't really give away what the place does or what it means to the 400 people who come here every day. So we sent 88.5's Paula Whistle to check it out.
I'm here a little after 7 in the morning on a Tuesday, and for the past 2 hours, a steady stream of clients have been coming and going. It's a real cross-section. I see several young women in jeans. Others seem to be dressed for the office. There are a few guys in baseball caps, and there's an elderly gentleman going through the door who uses a walker.
Am I right in your way?
Yes.
What they have in common is they're all here to get their daily dose of methadone.
Okay, you're good.
Yep.
Thank you. Perfect. Thank you.
Everyone here is addicted to either heroin or prescription pain meds. Methadone, which is also an opioid, helps them get off those drugs. People drive from all over, Olympia, Gig Harbor, just to get their methadone. It comes in liquid form, which you drink out of a paper cup. Most clients are only here for about 10 minutes. They come, take their medication, then in many cases, head off to work. The most difficult part of recovery is walking through the door for the first time.
My name's Taylor, and I'm 44 years old, and I've been coming here for, in April, it will be 2 years.
Taylor, which isn't her actual name, she asked that we protect her identity, could easily be mistaken for staff. Fashionably dressed, her shoulder-length dark hair well-groomed, she holds a Starbucks coffee cup while we chat. Her journey into opioid addiction began like it does for so many, with an injury, in her case, a car accident, and pain medication prescribed by her doctor.
I ended up with a broken foot and a broken ankle, and, you know, here it was, using them for, you know, a legitimate reason, and pretty soon it starts to become something to make it easier to deal with the world.
Things started to fall apart. Taylor, who was working, going to school, and dealing with being a single parent, ended up declaring bankruptcy because she had so many medical bills. As a result, she lost her doctor and her access to pain meds. It was a tipping point. The moment when she went from using legally prescribed drugs to ones that came from the street.
I was like, what the heck am I going to do? And somebody says, oh, I know somebody, and they actually have some medication, and they'll sell it to you. And I didn't ask questions why they were selling them. I had no clue. It wasn't my business, or so I thought. It just, so many stresses in your life, it gets easier to, oh, I don't have to deal with that. I can just stuff it down. You take another pill, and it's like, I'm not anxious. Okay, I can deal with that. I wasn't one of those people that just took it and nodded out and did nothing with my life. I mean, I was going to school 21 credits. I was working a full-time job. I had being a single mom, and I took care of my parents who were disabled. And, you know, all of these things just kept coming, and there was no time, you know, to just stop and really deal with myself. I felt like one of these days my number's going to be up. Do you know what I mean? It's like, what if I get caught getting this from somebody? What's going to happen then? Then you're really going to lose your home and your kids and your car and your career. And I really didn't want to lose all of that. Who wants to look in the mirror and go, I'm living a lie? Is that the person I really want my kids to see? Is that the person I want to become? Because maybe I'm fine now and I have all these things, but I'm sure the person on the street who has a problem with heroin once upon a time thought the same thing. And I just didn't want to be that kind of statistic.
Things became urgent after she lost several friends to drugs, suicide, and overdoses. An online search for help brought her here to Tacoma Treatment Solutions.
And I was terrified to come in here, truthfully. I was like, these people are going to judge me. You know, I'm used to people looking up to me, and now I'm going to have to be weak and admit that there's something wrong here. And I was so lucky that the person who worked at the front desk, the receptionist, she took me back and she talked to me. And at that point in time, my heart was so heavy that I just kind of threw this all up onto her. And amazingly, she didn't look at me like it was a piece of garbage. And she said, you know, this is what we do, and I think it can help you.
What they did was provide counseling, group therapy, and of course, a daily dose of methadone overseen by medical professionals.
My name is Dr. Gregory Parada. I am the medical director here at Tacoma Treatment Solutions. And with regards to what methadone does to your body compared to, say, heroin or other things, I think there's a lot of misconception out in the community about what that is. people tend to think like we're just kind of replacing one thing for another, or you know, how is that not like using? But addiction itself actually has more to do with everything around, like what happens around the heroin use, like when you're lying, cheating, stealing, having to do what you need to do to get that, the drive that the high produces and the avoidance of withdrawal. Those things are very powerful, and they make good people do things that they would normally not do. So what the methadone does is it replaces that craving for it in a way that does not produce the high anymore. That just kind of keeps them even, keeps their brain receptors covered, and they don't get high, they don't go through withdrawal.
But isn't the high kind of what you're addicted to? And so if you take the high away, do you still have a desire for the heroin?
After a while, for most opiate, I would say actually for almost all opiate addicts, it's more about avoiding the withdrawal. The withdrawal can be very powerful. It basically is like the worst flu you ever had, combining that with diarrhea, vomiting. But it's like that, but 10 times worse.
He says it's up to the patient to decide if they'll stay on methadone long term or get weaned off of it. For Taylor, the choice for now is to remain on methadone indefinitely.
The nice thing is you take it and it's almost kind of like set it and forget it. The nice thing is not being obsessed or thinking about that.
There aren't too many clinics like this around. Communities tend to fight methadone clinics, concerned about the clientele they'll attract. In fact, there are only two in all of Pierce County. When Taylor first started coming here, she drove 40 miles each way every single day to get her methadone.
I would try to get here in between 5 and 5:30.
So in the morning?
Yes, in the morning. And so that would require getting up at about 3:30, getting ready, preparing everybody's stuff to get out the door. And then, of course, the traffic to get here, which can be sometimes pretty crazy out there. I kind of had to learn to kind of get all of my ducks in row.
Now, after 2 years, she doesn't have to come as often. She's given a 2-week supply of methadone that she keeps at home in a safe and doles out on her own. As for if she worries about slipping back into her old ways, she says all she has to do is think of her 6 children.
I just couldn't imagine having my kids go, "My mom died from an accidental overdose." I mean, how sad is that?
Taylor says this is something she's committed to for the long haul. The treatment costs her about $430 out of her own pocket each month, but she says it's worth it. It's a long-term investment she's willing to make.
That story from 88.5's Paula Whistle. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing. And today, for our 100th new episode, we are taking a peek inside some locations that have Sweet 100 as part of their address. For our next story, 88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe headed to 1300 Southeast Cardinal Court, Suite 100 in Vancouver, Washington. This is home to the United States Geological Survey Cascades Volcano Observatory, where 82 scientists track the volcanoes in the Cascades like they are their patients. They keep stats on them that are like mood diaries as they try to personality type them and predict how they will behave in the future based on the past.
You know, lava is really primordial. It's kind of where rock is created. It's a window into the earth, the really deep part of the earth.
The Mount St. Helens sector collapse, it was the biggest landslide in recorded history in the world.
When Lewis and Clark came through downriver, down the Columbia River, there was a large quicksand bar that extended most of the way across the Columbia River. But they never made the connection that this was a lahar that had come off of Mount Hood.
The eruption we had at St. Helens in 2004, there were some periods of time where the earthquakes were remarkably regularly spaced, just like heartbeats.
With every eruption that happens at Mount Hood, which sends sediment down in a lahar, Oregon gains a few acres and Washington loses them.
I've got another 10, 15 years to go, and it would not surprise me to have St. Helens erupt again in that time.
It's like thousands of years of boredom interspersed with moments of terror.
That was seismologist Seth Moran, volcanologist Larry Mastin, and hydrologist Carolyn Dreger. In one corner of the observatory, Bellamy found John Pallister. He is the chief of the Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, which has partnerships around the world to respond to volcano crises and help save lives before an eruption happens. He tells Bellamy that this program began 30 years ago.
It started after a real tragedy in Colombia where 23,000 people died when a lahar, that's a volcanic mud flow of the type that might come off right Mount Rainier, for example, came down and basically wiped out a city. It was a real tragic event, and it inspired people in USAID, off the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, and USGS to get together with the commitment that we'd try to make sure that this never happens again. And so that's the underlying premise of our work. We try to get to a volcano when it's acting up, but before it erupts, to notify people. We provide the monitoring equipment. We provide training and expertise, having done this in a lot of different countries around the world. And then our partners are the ones who effect an evacuation to save lives and property. So over the years, I guess we estimate we've helped our partners save tens of thousands of lives.
Merapi, tell me what the story of Merapi.
Merapi is one of the world's most hazardous volcanoes, not particularly because it has very large eruptions, but because it has a huge population living on its flanks. It's in central Java. Yogyakarta is the cultural capital of Indonesia, and more than a million people living right downslope on the south side of that volcano. It erupts on average, every 4 years. In 2010, though, it had what we call a 100-year eruption, much, much larger than its normal eruptions, and the onset and the precursors were very short-lived. And so within about a week, it went from looking like a normal small eruption to a much, much larger eruption. Fortunately, our partners had really worked closely with the communities, much like we do here with the communities around Tacoma and up around Mount Rainier, or here in Mount Hood for Portland. They had worked very closely with those communities, so they had evacuation plans, they had the whole system set up. And again, the night of the eruption, they went from 15 to 20 kilometers for the evacuation radius from the volcano. And in that 15 to 20 kilometers, that meant effectively about 80,000 people had to run for their lives down the hill. They succeeded, and they saved about 20,000 lives, I calculate.
Wow. So we were talking earlier about how this is not just about saving lives, though. In some cases, it's helping with international relations. And it's also helping your team stay in shape as they work internationally. They stay in practice, right?
And this is an important point. You might ask, why does the USGS have an international program? Well, partly it's international diplomacy, and it's helping the State Department. But the other part of it is we get experience that we use domestically by doing these responses and by assisting our partners and by having workshops to develop best practices. That those people who responded to Pinatubo in 1991 are the same people that responded to Mount St. Helens when it woke up in 2004.
Pinatubo, that was the big one in 1991 in the Philippines. The largest eruption on Earth in the last 100 years, I read.
Yeah.
It was in a densely populated area and many people were killed, but also tens of thousands of lives saved.
That international experience pays off big time when you get back to this country and we deal with Alaskan eruptions, Hawaiian eruptions, and eruptions here in the Cascades. In fact, one of our biggest challenges here in the Cascades is because the eruptions are infrequent, they're about 10 times more active internationally than they are in the U.S. And so by this international experience, we get them experience. We test equipment. The lahar system at Mount Rainier that we use for monitoring the potential future lahars has been tested internationally at other volcanoes that are actively having lahars. So it's a proving ground for our instrumentation. It's a proving ground for our people. I like to say that you wouldn't want a medical student to perform open heart surgery on you. You'd want that student to have some experience first. By doing this international work, our people, our scientists, our technicians, our engineers get the international experience that we bring home.
How does the communication work?
Well, the volcanology and volcano hazards community in the world is small. Most of us know each other. And in going through crises, you become fast friends. So, you know, when a friend asks for help, you help, and as best you can. So that's really how it works. It's based on friendships.
Yeah, it's a form of diplomacy. Through your work together, you learn other things about each other. And with the goal of saving lives, you're really rising above day-to-day politics.
We do something we call science diplomacy because, you know, when you have friends in different countries that begin to understand their cultures, their differences, their political differences, the science diplomacy, the humanitarian response, cuts through all of that. And so we've been called on in the past to come in to assist partners that also help our embassies and help our foreign service staff to build relationships that are non-confrontational and that begin to, in some cases, reestablish relationships between our country and other countries that have been strained.
What would be examples of that?
We were asked to respond to Ecuador, to the crisis at Cotopaxi. That's a volcano much like Mount Rainier, an ice-clad volcano that's subject to producing very, very large lahars, mud flows. And we were asked to come in at a time where the relations were not that great between our two countries, and yet we were welcome because of the humanitarian aspects of our work. Same thing in Nicaragua. We've responded in the last 2 years to a crisis at Momotombo volcano in Nicaragua, and that was a case where, again, somewhat strained relationships between our countries, but the humanitarian effort cuts through.
How often do you get the email asking for help?
We get requests for crisis assistance, for sending, deploying a team of specialists. I'd say on average, recently it's been 3 or 4 times a year.
Is there a moment over the course of your career, particularly in your years with this international program, VDAP, that you are most proud of?
Probably the science response to Pinatubo, where I discovered with partners the trigger for the eruption, what caused that eruption, and was mixing of two very different magmas. That mixing is what allowed the gas to exsolve to drive the powerful explosion. That was kind of a breakthrough in our understanding of what triggers big explosive eruptions. So it is a dichotomy. It's a dichotomy of, on one side, the scientific, the understanding, the process, the hard science, if you will, the physics, the math, the chemistry, that all goes into that. And then on the other side, it's using that science to then, you know, for this humanitarian effort. It's one of the fields where the rewards from that long-term scientific investment come very fast, and you can actually see them being applied to save lives. That's not that common. We see it in medicine, of course, when, you know, a new drug is developed, a new technique is developed. I think this is unusual in geology to be able to see the results of your investigations and your science be applied in real time.
That was John Pallister, chief of the Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, talking to 88.5's environment reporter, Bellamy Palethorpe. You're listening to the 100th new episode of Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. Our next story takes us to Issaquah and a Suite 100 tucked away inside a gray building not far from I-90. The building is kind of nondescript, except for a 15-foot sculpture of an upright string bass on the edge of the parking lot. Inside this building, something beautiful is born almost every day. 88.5's Ed Ronco gives us a tour of the beauty he found inside.
Quickly, minions. Let me tune you.
Suzuki Violin Class inside Hammond Ashley Violins. Andrea Talley is teaching a class to 5 students ages 8 through 13. It does not take long for them to leap right in and start playing.
So pluckers. Sasha.
They're all standing in a circle around music stands. Andrea, the pluckers, and the melody people.
Okay.
It's a special thing, I feel, to be able to guide a student through never having picked up a violin to playing it semi-proficiently. It's kind of a cool relationship.
Students who learn violin by the Suzuki method, as these are, start at an early age. They learn to play before they learn to read music, and they work in groups.
You know, they get to see the older kids playing often, and then they get to be the older kid as they get further along, and then the younger kids get to look up to them, and that's like a big motivational factor. They want to play those songs that they've been hearing since they were young, and it kind of provides the lights the fire under them to keep going through the books.
Every student is holding a violin and a bow, and while these students have taken the time to tune and get their sound as close as possible, every violin, every single one in the world, is just a little different.
It's kind of like shoes, I always tell them. You know, shoes feel differently, even though they might be the same kind of shoe, you know, same tennis shoe, it's going to feel different. And the same thing goes for violins. They're all slightly different, and they make different sounds.
So why do they make different sounds? The wood.
The wood is everything in the timbre of the instrument.
That is Bryce Van Paris, general manager at Hammond Ashley Violins.
Well, it's always a maple back and a spruce top, but it's about where that wood grows and at what altitude that produces a certain timbre or tone.
And it was the need for quality wood that grew this company. That and the Cold War. We'll explain in a second. Hammond Ashley is named for its owner, first name Hammond, last name Ashley, and he started this business in the 1960s after he retired from Boeing.
He was an engineer, and then he met other woodworkers who, at the time in the 70s, started experimenting with sound testing these music acoustic instruments and expanding their palette and trying different woods, like local Northwest woods were being popular because the traditional violin wood was stuck in the Eastern Bloc.
Behind the Iron Curtain, it was hard to get. So the company made violins with Northwest wood, first in the Des Moines area and now in Issaquah. The drive out here along I-90 goes from office parks and malls to trees and trees and trees. And nestled in those trees is Hammond Ashley's building. Lessons at one end, a retail shop at the other, and in between, luthiers. That's what you call people who build and repair stringed instruments, luthiers. This workspace looks like a field hospital. There are big operating tables in the middle where basses and cellos can be placed on their backs. Off to the side, workbenches, like beds in an emergency room. At one of those benches, Rick Wickland is putting new horsehair on a bow.
You're just combing it out there.
Combing out, gathering it together, and then wrapping the wire.
He's worked here for 11 years, after 20 working in instrument repair.
And you catch me on a day when my voice is going.
Sorry.
At the moment, he's hunched over a bow and warmly dressed in a black and white flannel shirt. He has long gray hair and a salt and pepper beard, all beneath a cabbie hat. He also has a visor with a magnifying lens on it and the word Rick's written across the top. Those magnifying lenses come in handy. Many parts of the bow are absolutely minute. Rick shows me a teeny little plug that goes into the tip of the bow to hold the horsehair in place. One end of it is perfectly concave, and it's really hard to see because it is sitting on the end of his finger, no bigger than a pencil eraser.
And I have to hand carve each one of these plugs.
And that is a tiny little...
Yep, small plug that fits in the mortise and the tip of the bow.
And you hand carved it. I mean, it looks like it would sit nicely on top of a dime. It's that small.
It's smaller than a dime.
A dime would look like a dinner plate underneath mm-hmm. that.
Yes. Well, it slides right in.
The industry has changed a lot. Stores have come and gone. But one thing that hasn't changed, really, is how the work is done. Still by hand, still meticulously, and in the case of the bows, still using real horsehair. It is hanging behind Rick on the wall in what look like giant ponytails. There's some blonde, some black horsehair. Some of it is premium for expensive customer instruments, and some of it is called standard, which is used mostly for rental and school violin bows. Rick points to a bow that costs about $100, and then?
This one I'm going to be working on and restoring, and have been, is $2,700.
For the bow?
For the bow.
Why?
It's the type of wood,
yeah.
And most of it is the way it reacts and plays.
I hope you'll forgive that question. I don't mean to be denigrating or anything. No. I'm curious what changes the value.
I'm a fiddle player, so most of them feel the same in my hands as, a $100 bow feel pretty close to what a $1,000 bow is. My hands are too heavy.
As we're talking, a violin comes in that needs to be restrung. The customer is waiting up front, and so Rick puts down the bow and gets to work. Rick says he does this work because he's good at it. It is art, and it is science and craftsmanship, and it is taking broken bows and turning them, once again, into something people can make music with. Hammond Ashley, who started this company in the 60s after his retirement, worked another 30 years with violins until his death in 1993 at age 91. And working that long is not unusual, says Bryce Van Paris, the general manager we met earlier.
In this industry, people work until they can't drag their butt to work anymore. There's plenty of people in their 80s and 90s, and just like musicians, they just go until they just physically can't keep up because we love it. We can't do anything else.
That story from 88.5's Ed Ronco. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. And if you haven't heard already, we're celebrating our 100th new episode today, and it's pretty sweet. So all of the stories on the show originate out of a Suite 100. Down in Pioneer Square, there's a Suite 100 that's home to lots of delicate, beautiful objects. Glass art. It's the gallery for the world-renowned Pilchuck Art School in Stanwood, Washington. 26-year-old Lydia Boss works in the school's gallery in Seattle. She's an artist in her own right, and she absolutely loves working with glass.
One of the things that I love about it is that it's so impossible. It's like you're hot and you can't touch it with your hands. You can't take a break. Like, there are so many things telling you no about glass. And I think that that's what's kept me moving forward and pushing against that and saying yes. I'm going to do this.
Lydia started to blow glass when she was in high school, living in Toledo, Ohio. She continued to create and learn about glass in college, and she was so excited to come to Seattle, one of the premier places in the world for this art form, that she skipped her college graduation to hop on a plane and move to the Northwest.
In Toledo, I was kind of a big fish in a little pond. I felt very comfortable there. And then when I moved here, I realized, oh my God, like, everybody is competing at such a high level. And when I'm interested in working for somebody, my competition for that work is with the best glass blowers in the world, period.
So for centuries, the place to learn from the masters when it comes to working with this fickle material has been Murano in Italy, an island just north of Venice. But Lydia says this is no longer the case.
Recently, the culture in Murano hasn't been very active, and people from Italy and from other parts of Europe, from all over the world, really, people are coming here because there's such a deep and rich community of glassmakers. And the reason that that even exists is because of Dale Chihuly. Dale Chihuly is originally from the Pacific Northwest and ended up settling in the area to found something called Pilchuck Glass School. And so that kind of created this little snowball effect of more and more people coming here to seek knowledge from that community. It's made Seattle kind of a global magnet for people who are interested in working with glass.
It sounds like it's the equivalent of if you want to be on stage and you want to sing and dance, you move to New York.
I think that's exactly what it is. The community here in Seattle and what that can potentially provide you with in terms of relationships, knowledge, connections. It's kind of boundless.
What is the community like in Seattle?
Glass is kind of a material that I think really demands a lot of attention and a lot of focus. So I think that most of the people who are living in Seattle and working in glass take it very seriously and take a lot of pride in the community that exists here.
How does it grab your attention and focus. That's just someone who is not familiar with this art form. What do you mean by that?
It's such a funny material because when you start to work with it, if you're going through a process like you're making a drinking glass, you can't just stop in the middle and go have a drink of water. It's the kind of material that needs to be worked with from start to finish. And there are so many nuances of working with the material, and you can't touch it with your hands. So it takes about 10 years to even really become proficient at working with glass. And so if your goal is to be an excellent glass blower, you're investing tons of time and energy and money into making that your reality.
Can you walk us through some of the costs involved in making a final lovely piece of glass?
You start by just having a studio that you can rent for the day. And that studio rental could cost you anywhere between $600 and a little bit over $1,000. If you want to add any color to glass, you have to purchase that color. The way that glass color is made is by introducing different metals. And those different metals create different hues of color. So like gold makes like a ruby red.
Actual gold flakes.
Yeah. Gold, it's like a powdered gold that gets mixed over a long period of time into what would otherwise just be the raw materials.
So the studio rental, the color, and
the help.
The help. Is it possible to do this work alone?
Working with glass in the United States is mostly derived of Italian traditions. And what that means is involving a team. And hiring a team can be very expensive. But if you're trying to make something that is incredibly difficult to make technically, you need to hire the best people to help you to execute that work.
What are the roles that people play?
Usually there's somebody who we would refer to as the starter, and that person is responsible for kind of starting the piece and getting color onto the piece, making initial decisions about the way that the piece is kind of going to be formed. And that person isn't necessarily the one that the piece belongs to. And then there are a number of other assistants in the shop who maybe are responsible for keeping tools clean and at the ready, people who are responsible for opening doors.
Opening doors?
Yeah, I know. There are a series of doors in the glassblowing studio, whether it's the door to the furnace where the glass kind of lives and you have to get in there to retrieve the material, or there's a door on a larger piece of equipment that we call a glory hole. And in there's no glass. It's just a big chamber full of hot air where you put the glass over and over to keep it warm and viscous. So there's often like somebody who's responsible for running the door, and there's somebody who's responsible for turning the piece, somebody that we call the pole turner. And then ultimately the most important position in the room is the person that we refer to as the gaffer. And that person is usually the one who has hired everyone for the day.
Is that the person who gets credit for the final piece?
Yeah. And that's something that is, my parents are a really great example. They're like, you worked so hard on this piece and, you know, we're so proud of you. And they couldn't understand at the beginning that piece didn't belong to me at all. Maybe I was being paid, or maybe I was helping because I so desperately wanted to learn. Of course, everybody takes ownership over the work and genuinely is invested and cares if the piece makes it or doesn't. But at the end of the day, the piece belongs to the gaffer.
It sounds like you have to be invited to work in this world.
If people haven't seen you around, or they're not quite sure what your skill is or what your personality is like, they're maybe less likely to invite you into their circle while they're working. Maybe if you're going to be a distraction, or you're going to do something because it is so team oriented, and if people are unsure if you can handle that, there are plenty of other people who are skilled enough to be asked ahead of you.
So you need to build trust and prove yourself.
I do think that there is a lot of that. Like I said, it is so team oriented, and without the love and dedication and focus of every person on the team, sometimes the piece won't make it into the box, we call it, or into the annealer. Maybe sometimes the piece will hit the floor and 4 hours of work or more is lost. And that's a tragedy.
So you could work all day and spend all of that money and have all those people gathered and taking their 30-second breaks to drink water, like no bathroom time, and then it breaks.
Yeah, it happens. And it's sad. But the real pros, there's not any blame. It's like the first lesson that you learn as a beginning glassblower is that glass breaks. And even when you're working with the material at the level that people here in Seattle are working with it, that still is like a fundamental part of what we do.
Lydia Boss, glassblower, artist, thank you so much for talking on Sound Effect. This is Sound Effect, and I'm Jennifer Wing. And today, we've been celebrating our 100th new episode by taking a look inside places that all contain the address Suite 100. The building our last Suite 100 is in is a historical landmark in Seattle's Wallingford neighborhood, 4649 Sunnyside Avenue North, the Good Shepherd Center. Tilth, a nonprofit that oversees community gardens all over the city, operates out of Suite 100 in this enormous structure, the length of a city block, which houses all sorts of organizations. The building is surrounded by several acres of gardens, a playground, large expanses of green lawns. From 1907 to 1971, this was the home of the Good Shepherd. Nuns from the Order of the Good Shepherd took in girls who might have been considered troubled. Many were abused at home and arrived from juvenile hall and the courts. Some of the girls were sent by their families. The nuns were tasked with making these young women more responsible and moral, providing structure. A woman named Jackie Kalani lived here from 1949 to 1952, and she spoke to Toby Harris for an oral history project funded by the King County Office of Cultural Resources back in 1999. The cassette tapes are old and scratchy, so the audio you're about to hear is Jackie's voice, followed by the voice of someone else reading what Jackie said, verbatim. Jackie arrived at the home of the Good Shepherd when she was 17 years old.
My twin sister had married in February.
She quit school. I said, well, if she can get married and quit school, I can quit school and not get married. And they didn't like that idea very well. And so my uncle, who was the sheriff in Wakayakum County, had access to the court system. His best friend was the judge. And he said, what this girl needs is a man's firm hand. So with my uncle's influence, the judge pronounced me incorrigible, and I was driven here late Monday night in February 1949. And I looked up and thought, I am in jail.
It didn't take long for Jackie to understand who was in charge. Her name was Mother Serena.
The first thing I heard was Mother Serena's rasping voice.
saying, where are you pussyfooting to, Smart Jack or Slop Cart? She had these names. If she thought that you might be in love with another girl, she would call you a mush pot. If a girl talked about home, 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 home. When you get home, you won't be home for 5 minutes. You'll be out on Second Avenue with the sailors.
For residents at the home of the Good Shepherd, you knew the time of day by the schedule. There were no clocks on the walls. The outside world, it didn't exist anymore.
We were totally kept from looking outward.
Our job was to stay in here and concentrate on making a woman out of ourselves.
Not everything was terrible here. A lot of the young women thrived on the structure at this place, the schoolwork, the chores. Many of the students made lifelong friends. Jackie says all of these things were true for her, and she eventually left and headed off to college. But then her parents sent her back.
I went to Seattle University.
I went to Seattle University and discovered bebop. I heard Charlie Parker for the first time and fell in love with black music. And so the friends that I gravitated toward were Augie Boone, who later became a pretty well-known jazz pianist in New York, was one of my best friends, and she was a black woman. And Mother Serena, she was very prejudiced against blacks. And she had got word through the grapevine somehow that I was hanging out with all these black kids. So she got my mother to come and pick me up and bring me here. Mother Serena had talked her into putting her foot down. I was here for another year, but I was used to minding mother at that time. The brainwashing works.
At this point, you'd think Jackie would have nothing nice to say about Mother Serena. But this isn't the case. Jackie doesn't look back at Mother Serena as a villain. In fact, Jackie is very forgiving and full of empathy. She says the stress of having to oversee, in some cases, more than 200 girls at a time and being tasked with trying to make them into responsible young ladies probably took its toll on this woman. Jackie remembers the moment when she realized Mother Serena was just another person trying to make it through the day.
There were some moments with Mother Serena.
There were some moments with Mother Serena that were wonderful. I remember one time she changed her shoes in front of me and then rolled down her socks, and I saw her feet, and I realized she was a human being. You know, she had feet.
She had feet.
Jackie Kalani now lives in Hawaii. She ended up becoming a social worker. Years after her time at the home of the Good Shepherd, Jackie went back to visit. By this time, she was married and had a daughter. Mother Serena was still there. And she had a gift for Jackie, a dress for Jackie's daughter. It was handmade by the young women who were currently biding their time inside that large building. Special thanks to Toby Harris and the Museum of History and Industry for supplying us with the recording, and for Brenda Goldstein Young, who read Jackie's words. This brings us to the end of the show. Sound effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Ali Ferguson. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Parker Miles Blom gets the word out on social media. Special thanks this week goes out to Paula Whistle, Bellamy Palethorpe, Ed Ronco, Toby Harris, and the Museum of History and Industry. Our intern is Amanda Abbott. You can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app, and you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. We'll be back next week with Risk and Reward.
It became clear exactly what I needed to do. I was going to walk over to Justin Bieber and punch him right in the face.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.